On this week's 51%, there's a study that explores the language around men and miscarriages.
How do men make sense of miscarriage, which is this really complex and really confusing and emotion-laden thing?
We meet a woman in transition, hear about a state grappling with regulating midwives, and writer Dr. Jerry Byrne shares her thoughts on patterns. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. University of Missouri study exploring how men often use metaphors to discuss miscarriages finds couples need to co-cope with the experience. Although miscarriage is usually considered a woman's issue, men also grieve the loss of the baby. And in a recent study, a team of researchers led by Dr. Haley Cranstuber-Horstman says men often use descriptions to cope with their partner's miscarriage and describe their role in the experience. The researchers hope the study's findings will encourage men to find helpful ways to talk about their spouse's miscarriage. I asked Dr. Horstman why she embarked upon the study.
So I started this research at the University of Nebraska with my co-author, Amanda Holman, because we noticed that as we got into our upper 20s and 30s that a lot of our friends had had miscarriages. And we found out that one in five pregnancies actually end in a miscarriage. So we saw this as a really important socially significant thing that happened to women. And we started noticing that a lot of our friends in heterosexual partnerships, their partners weren't really talking about the miscarriage. And research really backed that up as well, that that miscarriages that happen in romantic relationships really do affect the non-miscarrying partner quite a bit, mentally, relationally, and even physically. So that's what got us excited about doing this research on miscarriage.
So what did you find, and did any of the results surprise you?
So we found that there are these two supra themes of miscarriage metaphors or ways that men talk through miscarriage. That the two overall categories are first metaphors of miscarriage, and then they also use metaphors of their role in the miscarriage experience. So with the metaphors of miscarriage, we saw lost gift, cataclysm, death of a loved one, emptiness, and chaotic movement are the five metaphors that they often use. And then in metaphors of husband's role of miscarriage, they saw themselves as a rock, a guard, a repairman, and a secondary character.
I find the latter part a bit surprising about how men view themselves in this instance. So what do you take from these terms in both instances, and what's the impact on women? Women who've had the miscarriages, of course.
To answer your question about the surprising findings, I agree that the metaphors about the husband's role in the miscarriage experience wasn't something we expected. Those metaphors were really naturally occurring in their speech as they were telling us their stories about miscarriage. These metaphors about who am I in this experience came up really naturally. These are really kind of traditional understandings of masculinity and what men are and what they should be. So I need to be a rock. I need to be stoic and silent and help my wife, rather than really kind of thinking about my own emotions, processing my own grief. I'm going to be there for my wife, or I'm going to protect my wife. I'm going to try to stand guard over her and make sure that she doesn't feel any more pain than she has to. So we can see with these types of metaphors that men are working really hard in the marriage, that they're trying really hard to support their wives, and they're likely doing a great job, but to some degree probably at the expense of their own processing of grief and coping.
So this is societal, and this is how men have been shaped to react. So is there anything wrong with this? What would be ideal here in terms of expression?
So I think with both the metaphors about what men should be in a what men should do in a miscarriage or after a miscarriage, and also the metaphors of what miscarriage is, that they both really play into this expectation that pregnancy and birth should be really easy, should be really smooth, should be linear, that we expect women to be able to get pregnant right away, stay pregnant really easily, and then have a birth of quote, healthy baby. And so a lot of the metaphors that we're hearing are really responding to being really shocked that that didn't happen for them. And so in some of mine and Amanda and then my co-author, Chad McBride, our work that we've been doing has been really talking about the fact that we need to talk more about miscarriage as a society so that it's not so shocking and that so people can make sense of this experience when it happens to them, maybe a little bit more smoothly, and that maybe that they can also start to confront their own emotions a little bit more quickly. That's one of the takeaways from the study. So another takeaway is that, you know, although this is a woman's space, that the miscarrying partner, the non-miscarrying partner, is going to suffer as well. And so it's important to make sure that we're taking care of that person. And maybe that in romantic partnerships that we're thinking more about co-coping rather than, you know, just one partner coping at a time.
It's interesting that we're using metaphors, even the word metaphor, given we're being so literal and focused on words, instead of euphemism. It's interesting to me that you've chosen metaphor. Anyway, where does this get introduced in terms of learning? What are the points of entry in terms of education? You know, what is the most efficacious platform for this?
That's a great question. A lot of the miscarriage messages that I would like to see, or people talking more about miscarriage, would happen at a media level, or you can see celebrities are talking a lot more about miscarriage and infertility now, like Michelle Obama came out and talked about her miscarriage infertility experiences. And I think that those types of stories are really helpful in helping us to combat the narrative that pregnancy is easy and that birth should be easy. So I think those types of celebrity narratives and stories are really helpful.
You know, two things. By using the metaphors that men do, they're making, I would think, some women think that what's happened to them is negative. And while it's disappointing, I'm just trying to differentiate between negativity and disappointment or other feelings. I would think that by using metaphors and such in women's lives, it must make the women feel that what's occurred to them is not right in society, perhaps. You know, and secondly, if a woman has a successful birth following a miscarriage, the miscarriage is rarely discussed. The conversation about miscarriage then is stifled, making the topic taboo.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think, too, that, you know, we were talking a little bit about the difference between metaphors and more, what was the word you used? More plain, like more objective language to describe miscarriage. So the purpose of this study was really to see how do men make sense of miscarriage, which is this really complex and really confusing and emotion-laden thing. How do they use metaphors in a way that helps them? And we're not negating the importance of being really clear, really using more direct language at times can be really helpful. But with this study, we're trying to understand how do they wrap their brains around this really complex process and where they fit into the story of miscarriage. There's all this really interesting research about should we be calling miscarriage like pregnancy loss or baby loss, or does that kind of dampen the blow of what it really is. By using these euphemisms, are we in some way trying to hide the fact that a baby died, or was it a baby that died? And there are all these confusing kind of questions that come up with the context of miscarriage, for sure.
So what's next? Is there something you'd like to do as an offshoot of this?
Absolutely. So we have a lot of projects coming up next. One that we're really focusing on right now is stories about miscarriage and how husbands and wives tell similar and different stories about their miscarriage experience and what the implications are for how similar or different their sense-making is about miscarriage. We also plan to do a lot more research in diverse populations who deal with miscarriage at sometimes even higher rates than the populations we've been looking at so far, which tend to be more white, heterosexual, educated people, that we are really interested in looking at what does miscarriage look like in the LGBTQ community, what does miscarriage look like in different religious organizations or people who follow different types of religion. So that's going to be our focus for the future for sure.
That was Dr. Haley Cranstuber-Horstman, lead researcher of Men's Use of Metaphors to Make Sense of Their Spouse's Miscarriage, Expanding the Communicated Sense-Making Model, a study that was published in Health Communication. Next, Regina Fitzsimmons speaks with Zoe, a young woman in transition who has found a home on the dance floor.
Back in 2011, when I was just a wee child, I got into swing dancing, Lindy Hop, and got into it for a girl I was dating. Very nervously, and I fell in love with dancing. I fell in love with her. The relationship didn't last, but the relationship with dancing did. Lindy Hop is a partner dance, and so there's the role of the lead and the role of the follower. The lead is the person who picks all the moves, and I always describe it as the person who has to nonstop think 24/7. The follower is the person who has to not guess any of the moves. I always describe that as mastering the art of meditation. Like, you have to be fluid and open to whatever comes. Back when Lindy Hop started in the 30s, you know, a fine young gentleman would ask a young lady to dance. They'd spend 3.5 minutes together, and then they'd get married. And that was that. But these days, people, they dance whatever role they want to. And as an instructor, you dance both.
Here's how it should look, man. Watch my feet. That's triple step, triple step.
I love leading people, because when you dance with an individual, you're falling in love for 3 minutes. And then you leave and you're like, thank you so much for that moment of just bliss. As a follow, you get this relinquishment that can come with it. And I would be heartbroken to not feel like I'm giving that gift and also not feel that the love that comes from the relinquishment, both. So my name is Zoe. My pronouns are she, her. I'm a graduate student at the University of Montana in creative writing and also in literary fiction. And I'm also a staff member in the biology department. And I'm also a dance instructor at the Downtown Dance Collective. For a long time, I went, what is it that you're actually looking for? What is it the thing that, as people asked, what is it that you want that makes you feel like you're trans? And for me, it was less of a wanting and more of this just enormous absence as you move through the world. It starts to consume you. That as you go out in the world and people experience you, you felt like they were experiencing something slightly off center. They were looking at you, they were seeing you, but they weren't seeing you. They were seeing this sidestepped after image. And the you that actually was there was something else. That first moment where someone experiences you as a woman and you go, this is the thing. This is that void. It's like, I mean no hyperbole by this, it's like someone's looking at you for the first time, like you were seen. And that is a, you'll take all the bigotry in the world for that feeling. Because there's nothing like it. When I talk about trans activism and when I talk about coming out and all of that, that instead of saying, oh my God, you're so brave, someone would say, God, that sounds exhausting. That sounds just, holy crap. And just look at me in the way that said, I know what it's like to just feel like you can't stop thinking about the thing. Like there's not a moment's rest. Because that's what it's like. That's what it's like to be trans and not out. To be trans and trying to hide it from yourself or from your family or your friends. It's like a voice inside your throat that is pressing from the inside out. You can't, It's like, God. It's like a never-ending pressure that you just wish someone would look at and say, I don't know how you've managed to make it so far. Rest. Rest here. Rest now. I see you. It's okay. And that'd be the magic. As I transition, it's become really important to me to have spaces that I claim. I want this bar, I want this coffee shop to be my trans space so that as I go there, I'm never going there in quote unquote boy mode. You're going there as me. And the dance floor, thankfully, has always been one of those spaces. There's never been the question of, okay, do I have to establish? Do I have to da-da-da? I just said, this is who I am. And everyone went, great. Will you keep dancing with us? That's the purity. That's the sort of the cleansing nature. And I don't use this word lightly, the sanctity of dance for me. That moment you get to not worry about who you are. You get to be you, but also invisible.
This story was produced by University of Montana grad student Regina Fitzsimmons. Most Midwestern states license and regulate midwives who are specifically trained to handle out-of-hospital births. Illinois is not one of them, and advocates say that has created a problem for mothers who want a home birth. Carrie Vickery is the vice president of the Illinois Friends of Midwives, an advocacy group. She spoke with Side Effects Public Media's Christine Herman about why she considers the home birth situation in Illinois a maternity care crisis.
We have a lot of women families who are interested in having a home birth for a lot of different reasons, personal reasons, religious reasons, philosophical reasons. And because the state has chosen not to license or otherwise legalize trained home birth providers, a lot of these women don't have a provider at all. And so what that means is that they go looking for a provider, they can't find one, and some of them will choose to just have a birth at home without any attendant. So when you have birth attendants and you can't verify their training, then that puts mothers and babies at risk for a bad outcome, or it puts them at risk for not having the best resource they could at home to keep their home birth safe.
Because as it is, there are home birth midwives who work in Illinois, but you're saying licensing them would help that system to be regulated so that it wouldn't be essentially an underground market?
Correct. And what we have now is an underground market.
The committee that would be formed with this joint resolution that the Senate just passed would provide the General Assembly with a consumer-focused, evidence-based solution to the home birth issue here. Why do you see this as an important first step toward your end goal of having Illinois licensed home birth midwives?
Various groups have been working on licensure for more than 40 years. What I've seen personally, what I have gathered from talking with the people who've come before me, is that there are various groups, but usually the medical societies, who persistently choose not to work with us on language that would hopefully come to a bill that would be acceptable to them, acceptable to consumers. And so the hope is that this resolution would bring together the different parties who feel that they have an interest in home birth and in mothers, and kind of force them to come up with language or actually to discuss what the real heart of the issue is.
Do you have a personal interest in this issue as well? Have you had a home birth yourself?
Well, all three of my births were planned with home birth midwives. My first birth actually was a transfer from home, non-emergent, to the hospital, and everybody was fine. And we did that under the suggestion and guidance of our midwives.
What would you say to someone who says, why don't these women just have their babies in the hospital? Because sometimes we hear it described as, well, home birth would be safer if midwives were licensed. But then we have the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. Their position is the safest place for a baby to be born is in a hospital. What's your response to that?
Well, there are always going to be families who choose for their own personal religious reasons, their philosophical beliefs. Sometimes it could be trauma related to not go back to a hospital. And here in Illinois, nurse midwives are licensed as nurses to be able to attend home births. I think there are a couple of nurse midwives, like literally a couple, it's like three maybe in central Illinois, but their ability to attend is pretty limited by their whatever their licensing rules are. So that means that, you know, women still don't have access to midwives just because there aren't enough nurse midwives who are able to attend home births. So when you have a group of people who you know will not choose to go to the hospital, I think it's far safer to make sure that they have licensed providers than it is to just say, well, you shouldn't do that, and we're not going to give you any access to any kind of a trained provider.
Carrie Vickery is the vice president of the Illinois Friends of Midwives, an advocacy group. She was speaking with Side Effects Public Media's Christine Herman. Now, writer Dr. Jerry Burns considers the burden of patterns.
I thought I rose above those painful middle and high school memories, those feelings of being left out and overlooked. I thought I left it all behind with my algebra notebooks. But those hurts still smolder because patterns are hard to break. I realized all this because of the good side of social media. Bots, political diatribes, and silly quizzes aside, social media has really given the world serious positives. Like when I reconnected with old high school friends. That was a gift. Slowly but surely, different people from growing up showed up in my cyber life. Not only did I reconnect with those folks online and in person, but I also developed connections with people who I never really hung out with in high school. What could be wrong with that? Nothing. At least for a while. A group of high school women started up a Facebook Messenger group to stay in touch and arrange periodic meetups. One day, one of them posted a link to a new recording on her timeline. It was by a high school classmate. Though he's not a professional musician, he's played music and written songs all his life. She excitedly told her regular Facebook friends to get it, and later that morning she hawked the album on our closed Facebook group. You have to buy this recording. It's available on iTunes. I've listened to it already, and it's great. Soon after that, the notifications started up. One friend said, "Yes, he's amazing. I'll order mine later." Another added, "I can't wait to order mine. I've always liked his music." Their lovely, heartfelt support of an old friend reflects the good that comes from social media connections. Yet for some reason, I found it upsetting. With each additional message, I grew more upset. What was going on? Since I wasn't finding the answer, I decided to work it out on my daily treadmill routine. I set the workout to a steep hill and walked vigorously. It's the setting that helps me best reset both mind and body. While pumping uphill, another notification came in. I stupidly looked at it. Another pang poked at my insides. What was going on? Why did this bother me? I was proud of him, too. My reaction made no sense. So I didn't check my phone again, just let it go from my mind and worked my body. And it's the moments when we stop thinking so hard that clarity sets in. I guess you could say that when we let things go, we let things come. My upset had nothing to do with his recording or my friend's support for his art. It had to do with my memory of middle and high school. Patterns are hard to break. You see, the week before, I also released an album, and I heard barely a squeak from high school friends about it. And so it brought up memories of being overlooked in the past, and I was feeling the same way now. Patterns are hard to break. I realized that this is petty. It isn't worth mentioning to them. This is my stuff, my leftover childhood aches and pains. But no one likes aches and pains. Take my niece Devin, for example. One night, she showed me something that she wanted to share with friends on Facebook. It reflected her feelings about guns and the Parkland shooting. But she wouldn't post it because she just didn't want her timeline, and therefore her real-life personhood, bombarded with arguments and nastiness. I just don't need that in my life, she said. So instead of posting, she shared the idea with us around the supper table. And two very cool things happened. One, we had healthy old-school discussion. And two, it kept her social media feed free of negativity. Self-care happens in all kinds of ways, like walking uphill on a treadmill, meditating, sleeping enough, and taking control of social media. My situation was as petty as they come, but it bothered me, and that made it worth doing something about it. And the answer was simple. I followed my wise niece's example and took control of my social media world. I exited the private group conversation. No more notifications, no more unnecessary reminders of hard moments growing up. It was emotional decluttering at its finest, not because of Marie Kondo, but because of my niece, Devin. While it's true that I can't change the interactional pattern of my childhood friends, I can change how I interact with it. Patterns may be hard to break, but if you engage in action instead of reaction, it is sometimes possible to break free of patterns.
Dr. Jerry Burns is a storyteller, writer, and educator living in New York's Hudson Valley. You can find her at storycrafters.com. Burns also is an adjunct professor in the Department of Communication at the State University of New York at New Paltz. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Elizabeth Hill for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1555.